Let me just say to begin with what a joy and privilege it is to be able to share with you today in worship. And I'm very delighted not only to have had one of my favourite Welsh hymn tunes just now, but also a specially written trumpet voluntary to bring me in. Let's go back to that road to Emmaus about which we've just been hearing. Two of the disciples were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. Two disciples, they're not named. We don't even know if they were members of the 12 or not. And that actually helps us to identify with them a bit. Two disciples, rather like us, trying to be disciples. But two disciples who have got a problem. They're walking in the wrong direction. They're walking away from Jerusalem. They're walking away from the cross and the resurrection. And they're talking about what had happened. You can imagine the conversation. We had some really good times with Jesus, didn't we? Pity about what happened. Now, I don't suggest that Christians put it quite like that these days, but there can be sometimes in our faith an element of that. Looking backwards, we had some good times. Pity about what happened. We had some good times in the first, second, or third Christian century. We had some good times in the Middle Ages. We had some good times at the Reformation. We had some very good times with Queen Victoria. Pity about what happened. How did we get here when we often feel, as a church, that perhaps we're at a disadvantage now? Perhaps we're in the middle of a more hostile environment. And some of us may be tempted occasionally to feel, well, the great days are over. And like those two disciples, we drift in the general direction of Emmaus, wherever that is, and we don't realise that behind us the dawn is coming up over Jerusalem. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near. I suspect I'm not the only person who thinks of those words occasionally in the middle of discussions and negotiations. In general synod or whatever. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near. And again, I have a rather vivid impression of the disciples having this wonderful nostalgic conversation and finally hearing someone clearing his throat more and more loudly beside them. Just as in some of our discussions about where we are and what our problems are, we need to hear that divine throat clearing from time to time. Someone saying, actually, I am here. And the conversation unfolds. And the strange thing is that, in a way, Jesus begins with the drift of their walk and their conversation. He walks with them. He too walks with them away from the cross and the resurrection for the moment. And he too talks about the past. Beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. He talks about the past, and subtly and steadily, he does it in such a way that all this talk about the past gradually opens up the future. And there's a clue, surely, to how Jesus can shape our talking and discussing and turn it around. If we're going to look at our Christian past and all the great gifts God has given to his church across the centuries, we need somehow to learn how to tell that story in such a way that it opens up the future. We need to look back on these 20 centuries of Christian faith as 20 centuries of surprise. We need to look back at all those moments in the history of the church when people already thought the great days were over, and then were astonished, renewed, turned upside down by something completely unexpected happening. Completely unexpected. Because, as a great Christian leader I used to know was fond of saying, you can't plan resurrection. All you can plan is to keep your eyes open so that you don't miss it when it happens. And that's one of the great disciplines of faith, keeping our eyes open so that we don't miss it. And the more we're planning it, the less likely we are to spot it as often as not. During Holy Week this year, I had the great delight of speaking in Canterbury Cathedral about some of C.S. Lewis's novels, the Narnia books. Films, I'm sure, will be familiar to lots of you. But I referred also in those talks to one of my other favourites among C.S. Lewis's books, which is a novel called That Hideous Strength. It's a sort of science fiction novel, and it's actually rather gruesome in places, but I'm not going to talk about the gruesome bits to a family audience. There's one point in particular which, surprisingly, makes a very, very deep insight into how Christian renewal works. Some of the villains are plotting away in the story, and they're trying to decide who are the people who are going to be most trouble to them. And they mention a couple of names. Ah, yes, now he's a very active Christian. He's in all sorts of committees and bodies. He's always going to Christian conferences. He's going to be a real problem for us. And they mention a second name. Oh, don't worry about him. He has no influence at all. Well, as it happens, we never hear about the first person again. And the person who really acts as a focus for renewal and resistance to evil in the book is that second person, who hasn't made any great impact because he's too busy praying and loving and getting on with being a disciple of Jesus. And it's him on whom a great deal of the action of the book turns. So we ought to be preparing ourselves for surprises like that and looking back at the history of the church, listening and looking for those moments where unexpected renewal comes from unexpected quarters. Who in the Middle Ages would have expected the church to be renewed by a reformed playboy from northern Italy who'd had a rather unsuccessful military career and who started his new life as a disciple of Jesus Christ by taking off all his clothes in the market square? But St. Francis of Assisi made a really quite significant difference to the church's credibility in the most unexpected of ways. And when we look back on the church's history, it's worth looking back at people like that. The people who come from left field, the people God has raised up to make a difference, a gospel-shaped difference, in the ways we never expected. So no problem about looking back. No problem about telling the story, going over the records of what God has done in the church and what God has given to the church over the centuries. No problem at all. But just remember, we're not looking back at the glory days that are now over. We're looking back with our hearts beginning to kindle and our minds beginning to come alive as we slowly get the message that God is the God constantly raising up surprising people. Could be, too, that as we think about God raising up surprising people, we might even get the message that we might be among those surprising people and that God is asking us to do surprising things. Always worth pondering. You never know. But that's what Jesus does with his disciples. He walks with them, yes. He falls in with their style of conversation, yes. He looks back at what God has done. And gradually the story becomes different. The sun, remember, is rising behind them over Jerusalem, and the light is changing as they walk on. As they walk on through that day, the light becomes clearer and clearer until it's time for evening, and they don't want it to end. How does this story finish? They want to know. Jesus has slowly reshaped all their understanding of what's been happening, God's dealings with his people through the centuries, and how what's been happening to him these last few days in Jerusalem, how that is all part of the same picture. And as the sun begins to go down, they are eager for more. So what next? They say to themselves. Don't go. Tell us what's happening next. And what happens next is that Jesus breaks the bread, and they know who it is, and they know they've got to go back into the heart of things, back to the cross and the resurrection, back to the challenges and difficulties of Jerusalem, and meet him again there and share the news. And here we are this morning, disciples, sometimes inclined to walk away from Jerusalem and away from the rising sun, sometimes tempted to look back and think, well, it was all very nice, but nothing much to look forward to. Here we are, breaking bread at Jesus' table. Here we are, I hope, ready to be surprised by meeting Jesus in that moment, the Jesus who is not part of the past, but of the present and the future. And perhaps this morning, as we come to this table, as we come to Holy Communion, to receive the bread and the wine, or perhaps just to receive a blessing if we're not quite sure where we are on the journey, as we can come with the question, so what's next? And as we receive Jesus, say to him, don't go away. We need to know what more you have to say to us. We need to know what you are asking and what you are making possible. It's true for each one of us as individual believers. It's true for whole communities. After an already quite full morning in Bicester today, I've been excited and enthused by the sense of a lot of Christian people asking that question. What's ahead? What's Jesus asking of us? Because we know that he has a story to tell us and a future to prepare for us. All the work that's being done at Emmanuel, all the work that's being done here to rethink, to reinvent the shape of this church, all the prospects opened up in the eco-town, all of that, Jesus is there waiting to meet us. Jesus is asking us to be surprising. And here we are in a building and in a place with a great history and a great heritage. And how wonderful it is to celebrate that heritage and look back at that history, not because it's all part of the past and it was all very nice once, but to see what there is here, what there is around us that will enthuse us and equip us for responses to all these new situations. Because that, dear friends, is what the resurrection is essentially about. Belief in the resurrection is belief, quite simply, that what Jesus was, he is and always will be. And what Jesus did, he does and always will do. That he never belongs to the past, but always to today and tomorrow as well. And that means we ourselves don't belong to the past. We are always being summoned into the Christ-shaped future, whose dimensions we don't yet see, but which we know will be a moment of communion, of sharing, of joy together. That's the message that we heard in the Gospel, the message that we heard in our other readings. St. Peter, in his first letter, reminds us that the plan that we're part of began before the foundation of the world. Go right back to the beginning. And there was Jesus, bringing something out of nothing, bringing creation out of emptiness. There he was, and he remains the same, the one who brings new creation. So, not surprising that Peter, on the day of Pentecost, says, "This is the one God has made, Lord and anointed. This is the one against whose vision, whose standards, whose life, whose death, whose resurrection, everything is tested, everything is tried, everything is purified and renewed." So when we come, to worship together, to meet the risen Christ, to meet him in this sacrament of Holy Communion, to meet him in our prayers, our Bible study, we come ready to be turned around, ready to be sent back into Jerusalem. A risky place. You don't know what's going to happen. Bad things happen in Jerusalem, then as now. And yet, the risen Christ says, back into the world with me, into the future with me. I'm here with you and for you. I have surprising things for you to do and for you to say. And I am with you always to the end of the world. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.